I should add, always thanks to Mr. Kadish and Mayor Brown and Platt. We are very grateful. Mayor Brown, Rowan Moore. I'm showing my age. Okay. Case number 033531, Karamo Kaba versus EA Step.
Good morning.
Morning.
May it please the court. David Fuller representing Karamo Kaba. This appeal over exhaustion of remedies arises in a Bivens action alleging bribery, corruption, conspiracy to cause bodily harm, and failure to protect. We ask that summary judgment be reversed and the case remanded for further proceedings on the merits. I want to address the improper and unwarranted inferences that the district court drew against my client, but first I'd like to take a minute to highlight the serious nature of the case.
Since we only have a limited number of minutes, I wanted to find out what you think the difference is among the various theories that you've presented. One of your theories is that as the PLRA uses the language available remedies, and as this court has discussed them in cases like Pozo, these remedies were not available to him. But then you also back it up with an estoppel argument and with yet a third argument, which all, I guess, an excuse argument somehow. What's the difference? I mean, what do we gain by thinking of this as either estoppel or excuse as opposed to simply unavailability?
Those arguments are arguments in the alternative.
I understand that,
but there might be
a reason why this court is a matter of understanding what this law really means ought to think about a problem like the one that your client is alleging in one mode or another.
Well, I could see how adopting an excuse theory in this case could be helpful in future cases to give guidance on what constitutes extraordinary circumstances.
But why not just, I mean, if the law itself speaks of such remedies are available, I guess the question is, do we mean available on paper or do we mean available on the ground, if you will? Estoppel suggests some sort of misrepresentation, and as Mr. Kaba tells the story, misrepresentation isn't really the problem. They're telling him exactly what they mean. They're threatening to ship him off to Puerto Rico and all sorts of other things, and so it seems like an odd fit for a misrepresentation theory.
Well, I believe there were some misrepresentations that occurred in this case as well.
That's not really the gist of your claim, whether there was a paralegal there or whether there wasn't a paralegal there. I thought it was really just these flat-out threats.
I agree, and we've emphasized unavailability as our primary argument. I think that the Second Circuit has applied the estoppel theory as well in circumstances where there are threats and where grievance forms were withheld. And so I've cited Hemp Hill and I think the Ziemba case for estoppel in those circumstances. But it is a secondary argument.
Now, in terms of availability, of course, the reason the district court ruled against you is because Mr. Kaba was, in fact, filing other grievances during at least some of this period of time. Maybe you'd like to address that.
Well, he did not file any grievances during the relevant time period, which is the time period following the assault. And my initial point would be that the threats that he alleges the defendants made against him took on a greater meaning, a heightened seriousness in his mind once the assault actually occurred. And I also think that it's important not to overemphasize the number of grievances that he filed. The defendants suggest that he was regularly filing grievances. Well, in fact, he filed one grievance when he first arrived at Marion Prison, and then that grievance was appealed later in the month of November. And then he alleges that grievance forms were withheld from him, and there were several months when he didn't file any grievances.
Do we have any idea from the record what underlay this last series of events? At this point, if it's a retaliation claim, I understand that, but do we know what he was initially trying to complain about?
Well, if you're referring to the grievance that he filed in February, the one that was 1 week before the assault occurred.
Before the assault, yeah.
The answer is the record is very unclear. There was very little discovery that was done in this case. The report that arose out of the special investigative agent's investigation was never produced. And my understanding, I believe this is... I don't think this is part of the record, but my understanding is that particular complaint had to do with a staff person on another unit, and so that Mr. Kaba determined apparently that the threats may not have applied if he wasn't complaining directly against the defendants.
Okay.
But I'm not sure the nature of the complaint.
I mean, you present a difficult line-drawing problem for us because the BOP, of course, has a well-established set of grievance procedures with their forms and everything, so this is not a case where there's just no formal structure in place. And it seems it would be very easy for prisoners to allege that they didn't get the form and thereby evade the purpose of the statute.
Well, this case... has some unique facts that might help to distinguish it from future cases. For example, the affidavits of my client and of another inmate that were sworn and that allege this conspiracy, and that one of the officers was enlisting other inmates for the purpose of injuring my client, and that they were specifically targeting him for filing grievance forms. So I guess that would be my initial response.
Okay. If administrative remedies weren't available to Mr. Kaba prior to his March 21st transfer from Marion to Springfield, did they become available later, as Magistrate Judge Frazier suggested?
Yes, I believe that they were available. I think the record is clear that he filed grievances after that time. Of course, the 20-day time period had expired.
So they became available later?
Yes, he had been transferred to a different institution. I wanted to just address the purpose of the Prison Litigation Reform Act. It was never meant to curb legitimate claims. In discussing the bill, senators from both parties emphasized the problem of ridiculous, frivolous lawsuits, what Senator Hatch called inmate litigation fun and games. And as examples, Senator Reed and others pointed to cases in which prisoners were complaining to the courts about defective haircuts or being served chunky instead of creamy peanut butter. But in contrast to those frivolous cases, Senator Hatch, the bill's sponsor, also clearly stated that prison conditions that actually violate the Constitution should not be allowed. And this case could have been used as Exhibit A in support of that proposition. My client suffered very real injuries. As the medical records in our appendix demonstrate, he was brutally beaten in the head with a large stick. He was knocked senseless, sent to the prison infirmary, was stitched up and sent to the local hospital outside the prison. And he experienced eye pain and loss of vision for months afterward, and he tells me that he has continuing symptoms to this day. And as I mentioned, there's also real evidence in the record, even at this preliminary stage of the case, suggesting or supporting his claim that at least Defendant Laird recruited other inmates to do this to him in retaliation for his willingness to invoke the grievance process early on. There are sworn affidavits that tell a consistent story of bribery of inmates, because apparently there was the notion that Mr. Kaba was not a good person. He was filing too many grievances, and that he must be stabbed or beat up. And by the way, Mr. Kaba passed a lie detector test about all of this.
He could have filed a grievance here with the go right up to the top, couldn't he?
Yes, but that may be, but again, the forms, I think, must be available to the inmate in order to do that. During the special investigative agent's inquiry, my client alleges, I think this is in his complaint, that he was told that the regional office was already aware of the allegations concerning Mr. Laird, but that they hadn't done anything. So I believe that that might be a factor in suggesting why he may not have taken that avenue.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.
May it please the court,
Yes, thank you.
My name is Peter Meharry with the law firm of Fisher, Patterson, Saylor, and Smith. I'm presenting arguments on behalf of defendants Stepp, Yonkman, and Benson. I believe my arguments also apply to Laird, but if there's anything specific with regard to Laird, Frederick Hess is here to answer on behalf of Laird. Clearly, the question in this case is availability of the administrative remedies in this case. I believe the district court did have a sufficient and proper foundation for finding that they were available for Mr. Caba, but he simply chose not to use them.
How should we regard that in terms of fact versus law? Because we certainly, in for example, Dale against Lappin, have recognized that if the proper forms are not available, then that excuses compliance, or to put it differently, that the PLRA requires the prisoner only to exhaust those remedies as are reasonably available to him. And here, there's certainly an allegation or a contest of fact, if you will, as to whether those forms were available for Mr. Caba. And I'm not sure whether we should read the district court's opinion as acknowledging that there's a question of fact and resolving it adversely to Mr. Caba, or thinking that it isn't a question of fact. I mean, how would you characterize this?
The way I would look at it, Your Honor, is I believe we have to look at kind of objective facts. Take away Caba's own statements.
Why do we have to take away his own statement when this court has repeatedly said that as long as you're filing an affidavit, which you fill out on, or similar, you know, sworn statement on personal knowledge, naturally it's quote-unquote self-serving, but that doesn't mean in some common law sense, you know, that a person can't be a witness in his own behalf. So why don't we have a question of fact here?
Because if you look at Caba's own statements, they are self-serving.
Well,
and they are.
I'm telling you, I don't care about that. He's talking about his own personal experience.
I understand that. And what the problem is, if you look at his statements and if you look at the objective facts, I believe they're in contradiction. Caba is saying this whole time that A, I can't get forms, B, I'm being threatened. But during the same time, he is filing grievances and he is complaining to other prison officials.
But what if he's making a more subtle point? What if he's saying, I am being denied forms that target the people in my immediate area? You know, the BOP doesn't care if I file a million forms against, you know, more distant individuals, but Laird in particular and the people at Marion don't want me. In other words, it's a specific denial of forms. I could imagine a prison guard saying, I'm not going to let you file any forms about violence of the guards, but if you want to file grievances about bad food, go ahead and file them. You know, you see what
sure.
I'm saying? I mean, if that's what he's alleging, then maybe there's something more specific at issue here.
But I don't think he said that.
Oh, sure. He alleges that he was assaulted on February 23rd after he was threatened with retribution if he filed any more grievances, and just 5 days after he filed yet another grievance despite those threats. I mean, isn't it reasonable for him to think that the threats had become a reality and that if he filed a grievance about the assault, he would be harmed again?
But if you also look at the evidence, again, he continues to file grievances after grievances during this time period before
after the assault?
When he gets to Springfield, he files multiple grievances.
Well, but that's different. How about at Marion?
After
Marion, he would have no reason to fear anything at Springfield because it's the guards at Marion who are issuing the threats.
I believe the threats are just general from the guards at Marion not
right.
to file grievances.
Right, and so why would they pertain to Springfield?
Once you get, well, two things. One is, after the assault, BOP does provide for him to go above, outside of Marion, directly to the regional director, filing agreements with the regional director on issues inside Marion. He doesn't do that.
And does anybody give him the proper form? Or they, is he supposed to, you know, like one of these other people, you know, take a piece of a paper bag or something?
He says he never got the forms. But again, I think that's contradicted by the fact that he is filing other forms.
But at
so he's
this
getting
time
forms
period,
somewhere.
At the time period, after the between the assault and when he goes to Springfield, how many grievances does he file?
He does not file any.
Zero, right. So he that's does. When he's particularly deterred, right?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because that's when he just decides to file his Federal Tort Claims Act and this suit.
But that's exactly in keeping with one of the cases that says if you're afraid of what's going on inside the prison, maybe you try to go outside, in a sense, upstairs, if you will. He just takes the wrong, you know, technically upstairs move.
Well, I don't think he's taking the wrong technically upstairs move. I think he's just taking the wrong move because he doesn't want to go through the prison procedure. The prison procedure allows for a grievance outside of the prison. He doesn't even attempt it. The case you referenced earlier, they talk about the prisoner writing something on a piece of a paper bag. He doesn't even do that in this case. What he does is he takes an FTCA form, fills it out, files it. What he does is he files a civil lawsuit. He doesn't even attempt it. There's nothing in the record to show that he attempted anything other than filing this suit after the alleged assault. And the record is replete with times where for whatever other reason he has to complain, he files grievance after grievance. It shows an inmate who is well aware of the grievance procedure at the prison, every prison he's been to. He knows what to do, what to file. But he chose not to do it after this assault. Instead, he goes straight to court. And I think when you look at his statements, his actions, and the records, you have to discount his statements.
But isn't that weighing facts? I mean, why can we do that at this stage of the proceeding?
I don't think
I mean, it may well be a trier of fact would see it exactly as you painted, but how can we do that?
I think you can do that because this court has recognized just because somebody files an affidavit trying to manufacture a question of fact doesn't mean it has to be accepted when other evidence are directly in contradiction
of
it.
No, I think you misunderstand our law on affidavits. But anyway...
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Hess.
May it please the court. My name is Frederick Hess. I represent Mr. Laird, and believing that this argument has been well made on both sides, I present myself to answer any question the court may have, but not to prolong the argument. Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 1 minute.
Well, as this court's decision in Dale and the Smith opinion cited in my brief demonstrate, it wouldn't matter if Mr. Caba had attempted to file a complaint on a paper bag. He did what he could. He happened to have the complaint form that he did file in his cell, and he was able to obtain an FTCA form. But for whatever reason, and the record isn't fully clear, but my client has said he wasn't able to obtain the Bureau of Prisons forms that he needed to file to exhaust those administrative remedies. And so I believe that the district court improperly decided which version of the facts it believed was correct and drew adverse inferences against my client. And for that reason, we ask that the summary judgment be reversed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fuller. And, of course, you were appointed. Thanks to Mr. Kadish for the very fine arguments that you presented. And thank you, Mr. Meharry, and thank you, Mr. Hess.